I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January the 2nd of 1998. And so in a few days, I'll have 21 years, which is shocking. You know, I just don't even know how that happens. My home group is Allendale. I feel like we should have a three-minute timer up here, and y'all should just time me in three-minute segments because that's what I'm used to doing. I don't come from an alcoholic family. I'm the only alcoholic in my family. I come from, I'm a child of two non-alcoholics. And so I like to say that I just come from a normal, dysfunctional family. And we had plenty of dysfunction, nonetheless, even though it wasn't alcoholic. And I had really good friends growing up. In fact, I still have some of those friends today. I was just with a few of them in Florida a couple of weeks ago, and we all drank the same growing up. You know, we partied a lot in high school. We drank, you know, a lot on the weekends. We drank at a place that we called The Place. and they, you know, those people, none of those people that were in high school with me, that drank with me in high school, are alcoholics today. They all grew up and they all grew out of it, and I didn't. And, you know, it says in the doctor's opinion that we drank essentially because we liked the effect produced by alcohol. But it doesn't say what that effect is. And I like that it doesn't say what that effect is, because I can guarantee you that I drank for a different effect than a lot of people in this room. This sounds like a strange thing for an alcoholic to say, but I did not drink to get drunk. I never drank to get drunk. Happened all the time, but that was not my goal. I drank because it gave me skills that I didn't have. I drank because it gave me confidence. I drank because it made me feel pretty. I drank because it was easier to talk to boys. I drank because I didn't know how to flirt, and I was able to if I was drinking. And in my family, growing up, I had some kind of a sense. You know, my parents were accomplished people. My father was a doctor, and I just got this sense when I was young that you're supposed to have confidence. So I feel a lot like a lot of us talk about that. It seemed like other people had that rule book, and I didn't have it. It just got passed over. But I looked like I had confidence, and I pretended like I had confidence. And when I was drinking, I actually felt like I had confidence. And so, you know, when we talk about the promises, you know, some of those promises came true for me when I was drinking. You know, the feeling of happiness and freedom, and you know, I got that promise came true for me when I was drinking. We were going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. When I was drinking, I felt that. And the fear of economic insecurity will leave us. I felt that when I was drinking. And especially, we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. I had all kinds of intuitively know feelings that came to me when I was drinking. And I think that if I hadn't found those promises when I came to AA, I'm not sure how long I would have stuck around. And so when I saw what those promises were, and of course we read them in almost every meeting that I go to, you know, that's a lot of hope. That's a lot of hope for somebody who, like me, was looking to get that stuff from the bottle. I was what I considered to be a functional alcoholic. And we probably all have a different definition of what that looks like. But what it looked like for me was that on the outside, things looked pretty good. In fact, they looked kind of the same like as they do today. I live in the same place that I did when I got sober. I have the same, I'm in the same career. And, you know, a lot of things on the outside look the same. And I was able to function pretty well in that life when I was drinking. I would have told you that I, you know, that it never affected my work situation. And that was, I found out that that was a big lie. But I, you know, as far as functional goes, I didn't drink in the morning. I didn't drink, except on the weekend, because that's not the morning, that's the weekend. I didn't, you know, every afternoon I came home and I reached for a beer out of the refrigerator. And I usually had, on a, just a normal day, I usually had a beer or two and a bottle of wine. That was my thing. It seems like that should be a country song. A couple of beers and a bottle of wine. It's got to be some music that could go with that. And I was a big time blackout drinker. From the very beginning, I was a big time blackout drinker. And you know, those other friends that I drank with in high school, they were not. But, and the longer I drank, the more I was blacking out and the quicker my blackouts would come. Like I could just have, you know, one glass of wine and I was blacking out. And, but as far as being able to function, things on the outside looked like they were okay. But on the inside, I was falling apart. I was really falling apart. You know, we talk about that God-sized hole, and that's what it felt like for me, and nothing was going to fill that up. And I certainly drank a lot to fill up that hole, and it wasn't working. I hit my bottom a couple of years before I got sober, and it was actually in a really sick relationship that I was in. We were both married at the time, and I was in this relationship with this man for 8 years, and I got divorced after the first year that we were together, and then he spent the next 6 years getting ready to get divorced. And it was always going to be 60 or 90 days away. And it was sick. He was 13 years older than me, and he ran fast. You know, he just ran fast, and I had a hard time keeping up with him. And we broke up 1,000 times. And just like any sick relationship, you know, he would come to me and then we'd have a fight and he'd go back to his wife and, you know, just on and off and on and off and over again. And I remember thinking to myself one of those times, God, I cannot wait to get out of this relationship so I don't have to drink so much. And what happened was we finally broke up. And I started drinking more. And that was, I think, the first glimpse that I had that there might be a problem. You know, because I could always blame it on somebody else, something else, whatever, but that there might be a problem. And sometime after that, maybe, I don't know if it was 6 months or a year later, I had that first real moment of clarity. And I remember it so well. I've talked about this a lot in meetings, and that is that I was actually ironing in my living room, and I was drinking a glass of red wine out of a lovely glass, and it was at night, and this thought just came like through me, and the thought was, you don't have control of this anymore. It's controlling you. And that scared me to death. That thought just scared me to death. But I had no intention of doing anything about it. Because what was I going to do? I mean, everybody I ran around with drank. So there's nothing to do. What would I do? And I thought, well, you know, we have words for this in our literature at the time. This is not what I was thinking, but the words that I put to it now are, well, maybe I'll just manage this better. So my idea of managing it better looked like, number one, I'll stop making promises to myself that I know I can't keep. because that makes you feel really bad about yourself. When you're breaking a whole bunch of promises to yourself. And so I thought, well, okay, if I stop making promises, then I won't feel so bad. So I'll stop making the promise of I'm not going to go home with strangers. I'll stop making the promise of whatever, I won't go out, whatever it was. So I stopped. And I started not to go out quite as much. I started to stay home a little bit more. But continued to do, you know, the insane things that we do when we drink. It's amazing that I didn't kill somebody drinking and driving, or kill myself, because I drank and drove all the time, because I could handle it, right? Because I drove well when I was drinking. And I think that's probably what we all think. So that was the thing that I did. I decided to manage it a little bit better, and I decided to, one of the things that I did was, because I was such a big time blackout drinker, was I decided that if I had messages on my phone, which I knew I wasn't going to remember if I listened to them at night, I just wouldn't listen to them until the morning, you know, or I would listen to them and not delete them or whatever. I had to manage my blackouts, and so, you know, those are the types of things that I did, and of course it didn't work very well. About probably, I don't know, maybe a year or two after that, I don't know what the timeline was, I was at a New Year's Eve party. A lot of things have happened to me in my life right around New Year's. And a good friend of mine and drinking buddy was having a party on New Year's Eve. And so I did what I normally do if I know that I'm going to be at a party and drinking a lot and it's going to be a big party weekend or whatever the deal is, and that is that I'm bringing my clothes to your house, I'm spending the night, and I'm not going to drive home because I don't want to be with those drunk people on the road because they're not responsible drivers. And so I'm going to spend the night at your house. So that's what I did. And, you know, planned on staying over at Dawn's house, which is what I did, and got really, really drunk. One of her neighbors also came to that party. And her name was Brenda. She didn't drink. And I never really knew anybody who didn't drink. We had great conversation that night. Of course, I didn't remember any of it because I'm a blackout drinker. She remembered it. And we talked for a long time that night. We probably didn't talk about drinking that night. I don't know, because she didn't tell me that night that she didn't drink or wasn't in AA or was in AA or anything. She told me that later. And so we got to be friends, we exchanged phone numbers, and we started, you know, hanging out and talking, and she told me she was in AA, and I was fascinated by that. I was just fascinated by that whole thing with AA, because I knew I was an alcoholic. And also knew that I was choosing not to do anything about it. But I was still fascinated by the whole thing. And so I asked her lots of questions, and she was so kind and so sweet, and she answered all my questions, and I don't remember one thing to this day that I ever asked her or one answer that she ever gave me. She never told me to go to a meeting. She never invited me to a meeting. She never suggested that I go to a meeting. She did suggest one time that I go to Al-Anon, and I did. I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and it was at Hilltoppers, and I don't know if any of y'all remember back the old Hilltoppers days where there was AA on one side and Al-Anon on the other, and the walls were pretty thin over there, so you could hear the laughter through the doors, and I'm sitting over here, and they're talking about the alcoholics in their life, and I'm like kind of going like this, and they're laughing in the other room, and I'm thinking I should be over there. I should probably be over there. But I didn't go. So anyway, so we got to be good friends, and she didn't care that I drank. And that's real important, because if she cared that I drank, I probably wouldn't be here today. We talked a lot on the phone, because I could be drinking at home on the phone while we were talking, and, you know, she was doing her own thing. And then probably the next year, we were talking about what to do for the next New Year's. And so she decided that she was going to have a party at her house for just singles, you know, just a singles New Year's party. And I knew that most, if not all, of her friends didn't drink, and they were, you know, in the program. And that's what she decided that she wanted to do. And so on the biggest party night of the year, I decided that I wanted to be at that party and not out drinking at bars or all the other things I'd always done on New Year's Eve. I wanted to be at that party, knowing that no one there would be drinking, but also knowing that I would. And I told her, you know, that I was going to bring my wine with me, and she said, that's fine. And again, if she had cared about any of that, I don't think I'd be here. So, because it's New Year's, what do? I pack my bag, I spend the night at her house, I'm, you know, because I knew I was going to get drunk, which I did. And all the people that were at that party that night were in the program, except for one girl's son. It was his 21st birthday, and he was the only other person that was drinking. So I brought two bottles of wine with me. I kept one in the car in case you people wanted it. You weren't gonna have it. So yeah, I got pretty drunk that night. It was a fabulous party. I mean, it was truly one of the best parties I've ever been to in my life. We were dancing, and we were in the hot tub, and we were, you know, the party was going on till 2 or 3 in the morning, and I fell madly in love with one of you people that night. In that typical alcoholic fashion that we fall madly in love with, you know. He was 7 years sober. Why he was kissing on a drunk woman, I have no idea, but that's his story to tell. So, and he's the biggest cheerleader that AA has ever seen. I just love him to death. So he's 7 years sober, and he is telling me all about AA. And he's telling me about the history of AA. And he's telling me, and I'm fascinated. I'm just fascinated by the whole thing. You know, I'm mesmerized by him, and I'm fascinated by his story, and, you know, all this stuff. He's telling me his story and all about AA, and I don't remember very much of it. I just remember being mesmerized by it all. And I remember telling him that, you know, my life had gotten a lot better in the last 2 years after that breakup with that really sick relationship that I was in. It was on the upswing, unlike most people that get in here and they're on the downswing. But I told him, but I just can't put down that drink. I just can't. I can't put it down. And of all the things that I don't remember about that night, and there are plenty because of the way that I black out, he said something to me that I will never forget. He said to me, Lisa, you are a beautiful woman, but you have no idea how much more beautiful you'd be if you got sober. And that took my breath away, you know? So the next day, of course, I was hungover as hell. He went to a meeting at Northland, and he came back and he took me to lunch at Threadgill's, and he was supposed to be leaving town that day. He had a job that he worked out of town, and when he came in town, he stayed with my friend Brenda. They were very good friends, and he was supposed to be leaving town to go back to work later that day. And I said, the three of us were all sitting there in the living room, and I said, if you'll stay another day, I won't drink. And he goes, oh, don't put that on me. And Brenda said, I don't care why she doesn't drink, as long as she doesn't drink. So he stayed another day. And he stayed with me. And mind you, I have fallen madly in love, right, in this 24-hour period. And so he stays with me, and he stays at my house, and I... That night, I professed my love to him. He didn't profess it back. I'll just have you know. So, and that was actually okay. Oddly enough, it wouldn't seem like it was okay, but it was okay. And the next morning, he says to me, he's hemming and hawing around, and he says, I have something to ask you. And I said, okay. And if you know this guy, you know that sometimes you have to like pull the words out of his mouth. Like, what are you going to say? And I think he's going to ask me to marry him. That's not what he asked me. He said, will you go with me to an AA meeting? And I said, yeah. He's like, you will? And I said, yeah. And you know, what he didn't know is I would have followed him to a crack house. I would have followed him to a crack house. But this is how God works in my life, you know? Brenda never asked me to go to a meeting, and I probably wouldn't have gone if she had. But God put this guy in front of me, and, you know, this is where I wanted to go. So we go to Northland, and it was back when Northland was, you know, smoking and non-smoking, and we went to the non-smoking room, the small room over there, and we walked in. So January 2nd that year was on a Friday, which meant that everybody was off work. So we walk in and we sit down, and all these people are coming in, and guess who they all are? They're people from the party, from the New Year's Eve party, right? And so Brenda comes in a few minutes later, and she's sitting on opposite, and she looks up and she sees him, and then she sees me and she starts crying. So I had a profound spiritual experience in that first meeting. I knew I was home. I knew I was home. Plus, I already had the experience of seeing how the fellowship worked New Year's Eve. And all these people were there, so I had this built-in group of friends. And I just jumped in, and I never looked back. I never looked back. I wanted what you guys had, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. And I did exactly what you said. I got a sponsor. Brenda actually ended up being my sponsor for my first 8 years of sobriety, and that was great. I don't necessarily recommend that you get a friend, but sometimes it works out, and it did for us. So she was great because she really knew how to talk to me in a way that I could listen to her, that I could hear her. So, you know, I started working the steps right away. I went to lots of meetings. I read the literature. I worked the steps. I did all the things that y'all told me to do, and my life got better right away. Early sobriety was wonderful for me. I absolutely loved it, loved every minute of it. I just drank it up. And that's because I believe for me, because I know that's not a lot of people's experience, I was so ready and wanted it so badly by the time that I actually found y'all that I was all in. And so, you know, rocking along and things go along and things are going well and ups and downs of life and blah, 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 blah. And here comes 13 years of sobriety. And I had a nervous breakdown at 13 years of sobriety. And I can tell you that it was not because I wasn't working a step. That is not what happened to me. I had some things happen in my life, and some things had built up, and then I was taking some supplements that a doctor had given me, and for some reason it sent me over the deep end, and I couldn't get out. And I had a level of panic and depression and fear that I don't have words to describe. And if you've ever been through anything like this, you'll know what I mean when I say that. You know, depression is sad and lonely, and panic is terrifying. It is absolutely terrifying. The only thing I knew how to do was what I'd been taught to do, which was, you know, get to meetings. I can also tell you that three things saved my life. I had to get outside help. And I'm here to tell you that if I hadn't gotten outside help, I would have died. I reached out to newcomers like I had never done before because they didn't know how sick I was. And I still could tell somebody what it was like to get sober. And I didn't just give them my phone number. I took their phone number and I called them. And the other thing that saved my life was Citywide. It probably took me about, I was on lots of different medication and it had horrible side effects. But I just, you know, I stayed with it and I stayed with it and I just kept, you know, going to meetings. I looked horrible. I lost 15 pounds in a month. I couldn't eat. I couldn't speak anymore at meetings. I couldn't be alone. I've been alone a lot in my life. I couldn't be alone. I had to have people around me and I didn't, you know, I couldn't, wherever I was, I didn't want to be there, wherever that was. I didn't want to go to meetings, but I didn't want to not go to meetings. I didn't want to be at home, but I didn't want to not be at home. And so about, I guess probably 4 months into this, and it probably took me 8 months to even start to crawl out of that hole. But about, I think probably about 4 months into it, Harris, who was one of the founders of Citywide, who was a friend of mine, had said to me, you know, if you ever want to talk, I know he had suffered a lot from depression, if you ever want to talk, let me know. So I actually called him for some reason, and he said, why don't you come over for lunch? And so he and his wife had me over for lunch, and he said, I think you should think about taking over Citywide. I'm like, Harris, I can't tie my shoes right now. And he said, well, what's going on with you? And I just burst into tears. And he said, look, why don't you just come with me to the setup? Just come to the setup this Saturday, 3:00, just whatever. Just, if you can't stay, that's okay. Just come to the setup. You can help set up chairs or work in the kitchen or something. I said, okay. So I did. And what I can tell you about that was, it was the first time in a long time that I felt okay where I was. Like, it wasn't the place where I wanted to leave and be somewhere else. And, you know, whatever I did, I, you know, worked in the kitchen, I set up chairs, I did whatever. I just kind of followed him around. And he would say, are you okay? Are you okay? Do you need anything? Or, you know, how are you doing? Are you okay? But I remember that was something that was so important to me that I felt okay for a month. And so the next month, I went back and did the same thing. And helped do whatever it was that they needed at Citywide. And I had helped at Citywide before. I'd done some stuff with registration, greeters, whatever, but I hadn't had like an actual commitment, really. And so, you know, he would say to me every now and then, oh, you should really think about taking over Citywide. And I'm like, no, I'm not gonna do it. No way, not gonna happen. And again, I'm just trying to, you know, be okay where I am for 5 minutes. And so, I followed him around, you know, month after month, and I'm getting a little bit better. And I finally said to him, it was probably about the fourth month, I said, look, I'm not saying no anymore, but I'm not saying yes. If anybody knows Harris, you know what that means. So, you know, 5 minutes later, his sponsor came up to me at Citywide and goes, I hear you're taking over Citywide. Yeah. And which I did. So I ended up becoming the event coordinator. I was in 2012 for 18 months at Citywide, and it saved my life. It gave me a reason to live. It gave me a purpose. It was the five-year anniversary. We're coming up on our 12 soon. But it was five-year anniversary, and we decided, I thought it would be a good idea because everything was really old then. Everything was kind of falling apart, and the donation baskets were, like, torn up, and I decided, you know, why don't we like revamp this whole thing? So we did, and I got to do it all. You know, if you see anything at Citywide that's laminated, I did it. I went through 2 laminating machines. I laminated everything in the church. And so, but Citywide really did save my life. I met some amazing people. I had an experience that I can't even describe, and it absolutely gave me a purpose, which I desperately needed. So I've gotten to do a lot of things in service since then. And Solis said something when he told his story at Citywide several years ago, and it really hit me between the eyes because he talked about how his sponsor told him, you know, there's a big difference between willing to and wanting to. And I don't really care if you want to. I just care if you're willing to. And so, you know, I heard him do that. And after that, I called him up and got involved in the first year at CTC. And I called him up and I said, I don't want to do this. I'm only doing it because of what I heard you say. And so I got involved in CTC, and I've been involved in that for several years, and, you know, met some amazing people through that, as I always do in service. This last year and a little bit more has been, I want to talk about it because when I tell you what's happened, you probably, some of you are going to gasp, but I want to talk about it in the sense of the gifts that I've gotten from this. And to start by saying that, you know, growing up, I didn't really like my parents that much. My dad and I butted heads all the time. My mother just was, she was in my business. You know? And because of this program, I got to mend those relationships. And I eventually became my dad's best friend. And my mother got dementia. And she, as the mother that I grew up with, slipped away, and this new mother with dementia emerged, I fell madly in love with her. Madly in love with her. And my dad trusted me with his life. And actually was with his life at one point. If I hadn't been there, he would have died. But, you know, he told me that I would hear from his friends, and I would hear from people that, you know, that my dad would say, Lisa's coming in town, she'll take care of that. Lisa's coming in town, she'll get that done. Lisa's coming in town, it's going to be okay. So even though my dad and I still fought, when I learned that if two people are having an argument and one person stops, there's no more argument, I learned that about my third year of sobriety. And I learned it with my dad. That doesn't mean that I was able to do it all the time, but it was a huge improvement in our relationship. And so that got to be completely turned around. So November the 10th of last year, a year ago November, my father died of cancer. And it was pretty short. He had multiple myeloma, which is a horrible disease of cancer of the bone marrow. It's very painful. My dad had lived with pain all of his life because of back surgeries and whatnot, but this was a whole different, and he'd never complained. But, you know, to see your father in so much pain is a really hard thing to see. And God just kept putting me in Greensboro when I needed to be there. I can't even describe the times that I was there, that if I hadn't been there, something would have happened. Like, I was there when a tree fell on our house. You know, I was in Greensboro with my dad when a tree fell on the house. And it was just things like that. And I was there when he started taking that medication that made him so sick that if I hadn't been there, he would have died. And, you know, he was in the hospital that night in septic with a fever of 104. And so I was there when these things were happening. And so he died on November the 10th. And then 2 days later was his funeral, which is my birthday. 16 days after he died, my mother choked and died. And then 4 months later, my sister hung herself. That's a lot. That's a lot. But because I have a really big God who gives me the eyes to see things in different ways, this is how I see it. So my father gets cancer and he dies in about 4 months. And what a blessing that he didn't have to suffer any longer than that. My dad had a wonderful life. He was a very, very accomplished physician. And he had an amazing career and a lot of people who loved him. And he didn't have to suffer with that very long. And my dad was not one to suffer. So he didn't have to. And because my mother had dementia, she didn't know that my dad had died. So neither one of them had to grieve each other's deaths. And we told her. We told her that he died and he was now with her dad. And she said, okay, thank you so much for stopping by. You know, we decided not to take her to the funeral, which was a wonderful decision. She wouldn't have understood anything. And we got to be there for her. And I know with every fiber of my being that my father was still there with her after he died. She would say to me, Howard's taking a nap over there. I would say, oh, good. I said, he sleeps a lot. She said, yeah, he sleeps a lot. And then she'd say to me, Howard's riding a bicycle. My dad didn't ride a bicycle. And I said, well, that's great. Where's he going? She would say, I don't know, but he's riding a bicycle. That's great, Mom. And I saw my father everywhere in those days after he died. He was everywhere. The rest of my family didn't see this like I did. And I know that the reason that I saw him everywhere is because he stayed and took her. Their 62nd wedding anniversary was between their two deaths. And he stayed with her and took her. And that's exactly how it was supposed to be. And so the people who say, oh, how awful, your parents died so close together, how terrible that you're losing two parents. My mother's dementia had taken her a long time ago, you know? And where she was supposed to be was with my dad. And so I was so grateful, and I was grateful that I was there. I was there settling my father's estate when my mother died. I got to be there with her when she died. And 4 months later, my sister committed suicide. And people are saying, how horrible, this is the worst thing that could ever happen. Someone commits suicide. No, it's not. Not in my opinion. When you are suffering the way that my sister was suffering every minute of every day, my sister was not an alcoholic. She had mental illness. And she would not accept help. And I tried everything I could possibly do to help her. She got help for a little while, and she gave up. She gave up hope. And I was in that same place of depression and anxiety that she was in. And the difference between the two of us is I never gave up hope. I wanted to, but I never gave up hope. And she waited till after my parents died to do this. I'd asked her a year before if she was going to kill herself. And she said, oh gosh, you know, I don't want to kill myself. I just want to die, which I understand. That's what you feel like when you're hopelessly depressed. And I said, well, Kathy, if you kill yourself, Dad's not going to survive it. And she said, I know. So she waited. She waited till they were gone. And so what I know is that she's not suffering anymore. She was suffering so horribly here. And, you know, there was nothing. I mean, if she had been an alcoholic, she would have had some hope, you know. Or she, you know. But I know that they're together, and I know that, you know, I had gotten a dog in 2010, and it was too hard for me to keep her, and my sister wanted her, so I gave Colby to her, and she was the light of my sister's life. And we shared her a lot because, you know, that was the connection that my sister had, was sharing this dog. And Kathy made sure that I had Colby before she killed herself. And now I have this precious dog in my life, you know, who I know that my sister comes and plays with her. I know that she does. And, you know, I just get to see this bundle of love and joy in this little creature that has just opened up my heart in so many ways. So you know, with all the things that have happened to me in the last little over a year, all I can say about all that stuff is, thank you, God. Thank you, God. I got to heal those relationships. I got to be of service to my family in so many ways. I got to be there with my parents when they died. You know, I got to know what it's like to truly have living amends in my heart, in my life, and in my family. And there's absolutely no way that this would have happened if I weren't sober and didn't have this program and didn't have you guys. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you for my life and for my sobriety and for the lessons that you teach me and for, you know, there's so many things in this program that, you know, that get laid at my feet, and I often do not pick up those tools. I often do not. But I know they're there. And I surround myself with people who work this program well. And it's a blessing in so many ways, and it's not always easy, but, like, you know, what's the other alternative if you think about it, you know? So thank you for my sobriety and thank you for my life.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. It was fabulous.